You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, June 23rd, 2021, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, folks.
Kara is busy working this week, so she is off. I mean, I say off, but she's like so busy doing her PhD stuff. She couldn't carve out time for the show.
She'll be Dr. Kara someday.
Yeah, yes, she will. Pretty soon.
Can't wait.
Oh, yeah. I mean, she's, you know, as you may imagine, getting a PhD is a lot of work. My wife got one just a few years ago, so I know firsthand how much work it is.
It was all consuming, right?
Yeah, it's totally. Yeah.
I mean, I like to think, you know, I work what I feel pretty hard at my job, you know, and I've done long hours, long days and things. You know, not to PhD level, let's face it, you know. So that takes a certain devotion and a certain work ethic that I don't think really can be matched by many other things.
She was flat out for, you know, years doing that.
Yeah.
While maintaining a day job. Like, she did, you know, she was working full time in addition to doing the PhD.
Right. And still being a mother, wife, you know, and all the other things that life, you know,
smuggler, you know,
responsibility. Yeah, that's right. Mule.
We got some COVID updates for you, just because there's a few things been going on. One is the emergence of the Delta variant. I'm sure you guys have heard about this. WHO has renamed all the variants Alpha, Beta, Gamma, Delta. So the Delta variant emerged actually in December of 2020 in India. Fairly quickly became the dominant variant there, and it spread to 80 different countries by now, at least, probably more. But those are the ones that have been verified. Remember the UK variant, which is now the Alpha variant?
Seems quaint now.
Yeah, that you know, rapidly became the dominant variant in the UK, but now the Delta variant is becoming the dominant variant in the UK. It has been detected in the United States, but it's less than 3% still of cases, but the concern is that it could produce a new wave. So unlike the older variants, the Delta variant is definitely more infectious and more deadly, right? So it actually causes a more severe infection. The Alpha variant, like the previously called UK variant, was a little bit more infectious, but it wasn't really more deadly. This one is both. This one is about 60%, you know, according to preliminary data, 60% more infectious than the Alpha variant, which was more infectious than the baseline variant. So this is exactly what we were fearing, is that you're having sort of variants of variants and they're sort of building up. And it's more deadly, like you're more likely to get admitted to the hospital if you have it.
And you're unvaccinated.
The good news is it's still covered by the vaccine. So the existing vaccines cover these new variants, including Delta. But, you know, you still got to wonder, like, is it just a matter of time before a variant comes out that's partially or significantly resistant to the existing vaccines, you know?
Do they have an anticipated number of variants? In other words...
No, it all depends on... we'll throw the dice. And it's also mainly based on how much it's simmering along, like how many people get it. So the more this pandemic continues, the greater the probability of variants will emerge, meaning specifically variants that are worse, that are more infectious, because those are the ones that will tend to predominate, obviously. There are probably variants emerging all the time that are not significantly different, or they're less virulent. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, they die out or they just get outcompeted. So there's evolution going on for more infectious, you know, more easily spread, more virulent COVID viruses. There's every reason to think that this is going to continue to happen until we get this under control. And we're not there yet. You know, even in the U.S., which has a very high vaccination rate, we're not quite at herd immunity. But the other thing that's happening is that these new variants and these new waves in those countries that do have a reasonably high vaccination rate, they're spreading among the unvaccinated.
Well, sure.
So it sounds obvious, but, you know, it's actually happening that the virus is sustaining itself by spreading through the unvaccinated population.
Right.
The Delta variant, for example, while it's a more deadly virus, almost everybody who's getting admitted to the hospital with it are unvaccinated. The vaccines are about 90% protection against being hospitalized with the virus. So if you do get it, it'll be much more, you know, benign infection. So, you know, just we're at that point still, you know, that we still need to really, really push for vaccine. You know, it's good to see now that You know, the wealthier countries are getting together and like really shifting their focus to getting vaccines to as many people in the world as possible, because
we're all in the same boat together. Really.
Yeah, exactly.
That's where the battle has to be fought.
Some variant will pop up in some country halfway around the world, and then, you know, 2-3 months later, we're getting hit with another wave, you know?
Steve, is this something legitimately to be concerned about?
Oh, absolutely.
100%. Yes. Totally. So I wrote about science-based medicine. You can take a look at the data, but I said there's basically three outcomes at this point, right, to the pandemic. One is, we like really push vaccines hard and we get to herd immunity before, you know, anything significant changes, right? Before, you know, the pandemic will burn itself out as we get herd immunity sufficiently everywhere. That's the best case scenario. I doubt that that's going to happen, but that would be the best case scenario. The absolute worst case scenario would be that a new variant emerges that is resistant to the vaccine and the immunity from prior infection, essentially hitting the reset button on the whole pandemic, right? Imagine that.
That's not good. But the upside to that, I mean, you know, the thing that that, you know, isn't horrible, the silver lining, is that, you know, now that we've got experience with mRNA vaccines, we could probably very quickly produce a vaccine. And the testing, I think, would probably be less onerous, right, Steve? Since it would be a similar, you know, vaccine to the previous one, so we could probably, you know, produce it. But still, I mean, so that's encouraging. I mean, that makes you feel a little bit better. But still, it would be many, many months before you would be getting a new vaccine, you know, to block this new super virulent, and which means basically lockdown again and all that.
Yeah, imagine if we were back to square one in the pandemic. It's going to take another year at least. And it's going to be worse than the last one. Like, that'd be the worst case scenario. And that's not out of the realm of reasonable possibility here.
I read that Moderna is now tweaking their vaccination to accommodate this Delta variant.
Yeah, they're in phase one of testing a new vaccine that covers the new variants. So probably, you know.
Oh, really?
Yeah, we're still talking about, like, when are we going to get our boosters? And, you know, right, so far the immunity from the vaccines is still holding. But, you know, as these new variants emerge, we do want to keep track with them. I suspect at this point they're going to be doing an annual vaccine with covering the new variants and keeping immunity high. And then sort of the middle of the road possibility between those two extremes is that we will get the pandemic under control, but not before it becomes endemic. So it'll become like the flu. It's always just passing around the human population. It's not rising to pandemic levels, but it is.
But tens of thousands dead every year.
Yeah, it's like the 30,000 people on average die from the flu every year. So imagine like another 30,000 die every year from COVID. It's just, you know, exists. I don't know what the seasonal variation of it. Maybe it won't be seasonal. Maybe it'll just be episodic. And we'll have to get our annual vaccine, keeping up with the variants.
Right.
It's just one more thing we're going to have to deal with long term.
Right.
I think that's the most likely outcome at this point. You know, we could still hope for a better outcome, but we still have to fear the worst outcome.
But bottom line, if we go the route of the middle ground, then basically the people who have steadfastly refused to get vaccinated, those people all over the world will be basically responsible for the many, many thousands that will die every year because of this. And it might be 30, 40,000 in the States, but worldwide, it would be hundreds of thousands dead every year because of these people that refuse to get vaccinated.
Yes, well, the ones who refuse, right, Bob? But I imagine there are some places in which the access to the drug is still, you know, difficult. And so it's not their fault.
It still is. And they look at us and they're like, what the hell? People are refusing it and we can't get enough of it?
So, and unfortunately, on the vaccine front, there's recent news from the CDC that there are some cases of myocarditis that seem to be associated with the mRNA vaccines, the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines. So far, the rate is something on the order of magnitude of 12.6 cases of myocarditis per million doses. So it's still considered a rare side effect.
Yeah.
And the benefits of the vaccine vastly outweigh these risks. Of those people who do get it, most cases are mild and there are only a couple like had to get hospitalized.
Yeah.
So it's rare, it's mostly mild, But it's like one more thing that people are going to point to.
Yes.
Yeah, people
have already pointed it out to me. Like, oh my God.
Is it a temporary condition or this is it for the rest of your life?
It's temporary. You get it, you treat it, you're good. You know, for most people, like most of them, there's no long-term consequences.
Don't even need to go to the hospital.
But in severe cases, it can cause problems, absolutely. But hopefully they'll, you know, now we just, Pfizer and Moderna have to try to figure out what component of the vaccine is doing this. And if there are tweaks they could make to eliminate even this rare side effect, you know, to make it one notch safer. Again, this should not stop anybody from getting the vaccine. But, you know, this is the kind of thing that's going to crop up. You give, you know, hundreds of millions of doses, we're going to see these rare side effects. They're monitoring it. They're reporting it. They're being transparent about it. But, you know, do the math.
If you think about the vaccine as if it were a medication, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, think about all the different medications that people are on. All medications have side effects.
Absolutely.
Yeah, but you get my point. The point is, like, they're making a big deal about 12 out of a million people, you know, with the vaccine that can save your life. And if you're on a medication, statistically, there are multiple side effects to your to the medication.
Absolutely. Yeah. No medicine is side effect free. And if people used common medications as much as this vaccine has been distributed, we probably would see those really rare reactions to the common medicines that, you know, we don't see because not 100 million people across the world aren't taking it.
Hey, guys, hundreds of people in the U.S. die every year from Tylenol. From Tylenol.
Right.
Hundreds of people die. You know, there's 60,000 emergency room visits, 100,000 calls to poison centers, and hundreds of deaths a year. In England, it's a leading cause of liver failure.
Is it because it was misused? It was wrong dosage?
Probably mostly people are taking too much, but even if used at the correct dose, but over too long a period of time, or in people who are just sensitive to it, it's mostly people taking too much of a dose. But it's still, you know, that's Tylenol. It's like people don't even think about that.
Don't even think about it.
Yeah,
and also, to put this into perspective, if you got COVID, your risk, the risk to your heart is far greater. Than any risk to, you know, of getting this heart inflammation that some people are seeing.
I was reading another study today speaking about the risk of getting COVID. Like, it's always risk versus benefit, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And so the risk of not getting the vaccine is the risk of getting COVID, and COVID is a much worse disease than any, you know, vaccine side effects that we're seeing. But one of the things they discovered, so a number of people now with COVID are getting so-called long COVID. They're getting these chronic symptoms, fatigue, and other things that won't go away. They're finding that in 30% of these cases of long COVID, that their Epstein-Barr virus is being reactivated.
Ooh.
Because most of us are walking around with EBV, right? With Epstein-Barr virus inside of us, just not active, because we've been exposed at some point in our life. And it's now reactivating the EBV, and that may be the cause of a lot of cases of the so-called long COVID.
That's fascinating. Do they know how COVID activates it?
It could be that it's just overtaxing your immune system, and so it has the opportunity to do that. That'd be my first thought, but I don't think they know yet for sure how that's happening. But that's not uncommon for dormant viruses to be activated during times when your immune system is being taxed or you're under stress. Probably also, I would bet you once they look at the numbers, it might be associated with a higher risk of shingles, for example, you know, of that, because that's another dormant herpes virus. And it's another dormant virus. This one, shingles happens to be a herpes virus that, once you have chickenpox, the virus lies dormant.
Yeah, I had shingles.
Your dorsal root ganglia.
I had chickenpox.
Yeah, and then it's just sitting there your whole life. It may or may not come out.
I never had the chickenpox.
Oh, you didn't have it, huh?
Never had it.
Did not get exposed to it as an adult, that's for sure.
How the hell did that happen or not happen?
I don't know. It's not a good thing, right, Steve?
No.
Well, you guys said just make sure you don't get exposed to it as an adult.
Well, just Jay, in your household, you know, in a couple of years, you're going to have to pay real close attention to that then.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're right, man.
All right, guys, let's move on to some news items. Bob, you're going to tell us about ways of detecting the signatures of life.
Yes. Are they left-handed signatures or right-handed signatures?
Yes. Yeah, Steve. Astrobiologist researchers recently developed a system to remotely detect the presence of life. A biosignature created because Earth life has a very specific molecular property that changes light. Now, these are from scientists under the auspices of the University of Bern and of the National Center of Competence in Research, led by doctors Lucas Patti and Jonas Kuhn. at the University of Bern. Now, the key question you may have now is, what is that specific molecular property of life that's being detected? And it is called, some of you I'm sure have heard of this, it's called chirality. And I apologize in advance right now for all the times I'm going to say that word in the next 5 minutes. So chirality is a geometric property, essentially. It applies to objects that are not identical to its mirror reflection. So let me just dive into that a little bit. So many things are obviously identical to their reflection, right? Duh, of course, it's a reflection. But now imagine reaching into the mirror and pulling out a reflection as a real 3D object. I'm asking you to put on your imagination hats now. You're pulling it out of the reflection. So if you do that to a reflected, say, matchstick or even a ray gun, it would be geometrically identical to its twin, right? You could put them next to each other and they would be identical. You couldn't
depending on the quality of the mirror, but yes, assuming you have a perfect mirror.
Yeah, it's probably easier to imagine with regular solids. Like if there's a sphere or a cube, you know, or a pyramid shape, it would be identical.
Yeah, but it doesn't have to be. It could be much more complex objects as well. They would be identical. Some reflections, however, do not match if you pulled it into the real world. And hands are the iconic example of this. So the reflection of your left hand, imagine your left hand's in front of a mirror. The reflection is not identical to your left hand, but it's identical to your right hand. The right and left hands are mirror reflections of each other. Now, if you pull out your left hand's reflection and compare it, you cannot rotate it in any way that it would identically match your left hand. There's no way to do that. And so this is the essence of a chirality or handedness. Now, most things that we make are not chiral. They're achiral because we are just symmetry loving creatures, right? Everything we make, symmetry is beauty, right? But there's exceptions, of course, like left-handed and right-handed screws, right? But light can also be chiral as well. But most importantly for this news item, molecules can be chiral, specifically biological molecules. In fact, biological molecules are homochiral. They are found with only one specific chirality with very minor exceptions. So for example, our biological sugars are only right-handed. Our amino acids are only left-handed. And the DNA coils themselves are unvaryingly right-handed helices. Those do not change. They are the same with all life on Earth. So why? Why is that the case? This is kind of interesting to dive into why. The scientists generally believe, the consensus is that there was basically this just a random decision was made, in quotes, in the earliest days of evolution. So if we meet other carbon-based life in the universe or create it, for example, it could potentially have the opposite chirality that we see with our own biological molecules. There is, though, some debate about the specifics. Some people think that this homochirality was biased because God happened to like left-handed amino acids, and I am so joking on that one. What I meant to say was that early biological amino acids could have had a specific chirality because a specific type of polarized light that was prevalent at the time destroyed the other chirality of the amino acids. So what about abiotic or non-living matter? That is not homochiral, and so that does not have a biosignature. Just another little point here that is fascinating. Now, you may think, oh, so what? These biological molecules are, you know, they're mirror images. But so what? What difference does it make if something's switched around, like a reflection for some of these molecules? Well, it does make a difference in a lot of things. Like, for example, flavor, artificial sweetener aspartame, for example. One handiness of aspartame tastes sweet, where the other one, the D-aspartame, is tasteless. So it can make a huge difference. Odors can be different because of chirality. How about drug effectiveness and even drug safety? Some drugs are great for rheumatoid arthritis, but you take the mirror image of that drug and it doesn't do anything. It doesn't help at all.
That reminds me, Bob, I know sometimes pharmaceutical companies need to develop a process to purify the chirality of their drug so that it has the effect that they want.
Yeah, and yeah,
not
sure.
Unintended. So that's like a chemical process that we have to do, purifying one or the other chirality.
Yeah, I'm not surprised at all. So we've known about this potential to detect a biosignature for a long time. We knew that this biosignature can be detected, and they've been looking at it for many, many years and trying to find out how can we detect this difference in chirality? Because if you detect one type of chirality, then you know this is life, because only life has that chirality. So they have done it, and they've done it years ago, actually, by using or analyzing the light that is reflected off of biological matter. Dr. Lucas Patty said that when light is reflected by biological matter, a part of the light's electromagnetic waves will travel in either clockwise or counterclockwise spirals. This phenomenon is called circular polarization and is caused by the biological matter's homochirality. Similar spirals of light are not produced by abiotic, non-living nature. But it isn't easy, though, to detect that light. The polarized light that comes off of it is only less than 1% of the total, and it's easily lost in all the noise. So it's very, very difficult. So they had to build an elaborate device called a spectropolarimeter, which can separate the circular polarization from the rest of the light. And this is great. They got it to work, but they had to be at least 20 centimeters away. They couldn't get any farther than 20 centimeters. And they had to hold that position for a few minutes. So that was a good advance and good for the laboratory, but little else, right? You really want to take this kind of stuff out and do other things with it. You don't want to be stuck in the lab with that type of technology. So they upgraded. They did their homework. They put in some effort and they upgraded the spectropolarimeter and they call it FlyPol, FlyPol, pole for polarization. Fly, I don't know why, but still, I think that name is kind of meh. I think they should have called it SMS for Super Mega Spectro. Or yeah. Something like that. So the Super Mega Spectro can now be put in a freaking helicopter and flown around kilometers in the air, and they can detect signals in seconds. So huge. You're going from 20 centimeters to kilometers away, and instead of holding a position for minutes, they could do it in literally seconds. That's a nice incremental advance. It can tell the difference then between grass fields, forests, and urban areas. They can even detect the algae in lakes using this method. And things like roads, of course, do not have significant circular polarization signals. So that basically has no signal, exactly what you would expect. So pretty amazing advance. In the future, they hope that further refinements could help give details about the health of life, not just detecting life, but how healthy is that life that is being remotely sensed. It could give information, for example, about deforestation or plant disease or toxic algal blooms or the effects of acidification, for example. So pretty interesting application. I hope that works out. Sooner than that, though, we're probably going to hear about this Super Mega Uber Spectro being tested on the ISS for planetary scale biosignatures. And from there, the next obvious application would be to using this to look for this special polarized light, looking for life on exoplanets, which is probably one of the ultimate uses of this kind of technology. But that's cool and all, but I can't wait to look for biosignatures using what, guys? A real tricorder. Right.
Right. Of course. Well, Bob, you know that the Wand Company is making a duplicate of the tricorder that actually has real-world functionality, right? You know this, right?
But it's probably not going to have the super mega chiro
spectro.
No, but
that would be cool, though. Like, are detecting signs of life, you know?
Right.
Upgrade later.
I mean, I wonder how small they can get this. I mean, I'm sure that this device, this spectropolarimeter, probably pretty damn expensive. Don't know how small it is, but sure. I mean, I think it's a no-brainer to at least assume that they're going to make that pretty damn small in the future and much more powerful. I think they definitely will be able to, you'll have a handheld device that can say, yep, there's some life here. And what kind of life for sure? Cause each would have, probably its own signature. Like I said, they collected, algae in lakes, and stuff. So that's, if you really extrapolate this, it's interesting to think. Not only can you detect life, but, what state the life is in.
Jim, this man is a Klingon.
Or
Bob, what about looking for life in our own solar system, like turning this thing on Europa or Enceladus?
Yeah.
And would that possibly detect biosignature of life?
Yeah. I mean, the downside is that, the amount of potential life that would be like in the surface or maybe, shot out of a geyser would be exceedingly small. And you'd also have the problem of, maybe it's not homochiral life and then we wouldn't detect it. It would be bona fide life, but not, the best we could say with this specific technology is that it's definitely not Earth life.
Yeah.
But it could definitely help. Yeah, for sure.
But that'll be, obviously that'd be fascinating to know what percentage of life in the universe is homochiral.
Right.
Like, is that a fluke or is that pretty much a stable character of life, because they it has to be internally biochemically compatible, you know.
I mean, they could still have the opposite homochirality as ours.
Yeah,
I mean,
but, you know, whatever, but it's homochiral.
Right, and we can still detect it.
Interesting. All right, thanks, yes. Bob. Jay, give us an update on the space launch system. I know we've been talking a lot of space news recently, but we're heading into this decade of the moon.
SLS. Can't wait.
I know. I mean, Steve, we're talking about it a lot because so much is happening, right? We need to stay up to date with it because, you know, significant strides are being made. So recently, NASA engineers are now assembling their new rocket called the Space Launch System, or the SLS for short. We've been talking about this, I think, for over a decade.
Mm-hmm.
And now they're finally constructing the first one, right? So this is being done in Cape Canaveral, Florida, as we speak. They're prepping the vehicle for a launch date later this year. Now, this is for Artemis 1. I'll go into details about the difference between Artemis 1 and Artemis 2. So they brought the core stage to the Kennedy Space Center on April 27th, and they brought it in on a barge. It ended up being brought to the vehicle assembly building, where they stand up the rocket and they start adding components on it and put it into the assembly line process, which is awesome. You can see a lot of pictures and video of them doing this. Like, they have time-lapse pictures as well. Other than the core stage, all the other components have been brought into the vehicle assembly building. That means that for the first time, they've all been brought together in the same space. And this is a big deal because there's a lot of components. Another milestone is that this is the first time since the last Apollo mission, guys, that a rocket was being assembled for a deep space mission. We've done lots of low Earth orbit missions and everything, but, you know, we haven't done a deep space mission since Apollo.
Wow.
If you haven't done so, I recommend that you just go to the NASA website and take a look at, or, you know, just Google it. Take a look at a size comparison of the SLS to all the other major rockets that have been out there. The SLS is an absolute monster. It's huge. There are different configurations and modules that they will add on to the core stage, right? So you think of the core stage as the starting point, and they go, what do we want to do this mission? All right, we want to do this. We'll add on this module, add on that module. So depending on what they're going to do, like the cargo one's the big one. And that comes in at 111.25 meters or 365 feet. And this is called the Block 2 cargo version of the SLS. That's the giant one that'll blow your mind. The core stage itself is 65 meters or 212 feet tall. That's just the core stage. That's just like the main fuel cell. Solid rocket boosters are 54 meters or 177 feet tall. So when launched, it will use two solid rocket boosters. This will give it extra lift. You know, when they light the rocket up, they want to get it up and moving as fast as they can. And these solid rocket boosters do that with a lot, you know, they help an incredible amount just getting it off the launch pad. You could see a great time lapse video of them maneuvering the core rocket down in between the two solid rocket boosters so they can connect them onto the core module. So the solid rocket boosters are longer than the ones that they used for the space shuttle. But did you guys know that the SLS is powered by four RS-25 engines? Do you know what those engines are?
They're rocket engines?
Yeah. They are.
Bigger than the RS-23?
Yes, but those are the same engines that were used on the space shuttle.
Cool.
The same ones? Okay.
Yeah, I'm sure that they re-outfit them and you know, they upgraded them, but they are the same package. They're the same design. So combined, these engines will produce 8 million pounds of thrust. That's a lot of thrust.
8 million pounds.
So the advantage of the solid rocket boosters is that they have more... They have more thrust, you know, per volume there, but than liquid fuel. But you can't turn them off. Once you light them, they burn.
They go.
They're just used for. That's why they're used for liftoff, because you know you're going to burn all the way through them.
It's like lighting a wick. You know, you're just not going to stop it. Sometime in August, the Orion Space Capsule Command Module, right, the command module that they're going to be using for the Artemis missions, will be connected to the top of the core rocket. And this is all being done to test the entire system during the Artemis 1 mission. So the point to Artemis 1 is to send the rocket up with the command module and to run it all the way through the entire mission without landing on the moon, of course. They're just going to go around the moon, and then they're going to bring it back, and they're going to test out every function that they possibly can. If things continue to go as planned, NASA says that they can conduct this test flight in November. November.
Wow.
They're going to send a vehicle to the moon. Yeah. To reiterate, the Artemis 1 mission is the test mission that will fly the Orion command module around the moon and then it will come back to Earth. And the goal is to have the Artemis 2 mission greenlighted, and that then only the Artemis 1 test can greenlight the Artemis 2 mission. This is the actual, and 2 is the actual crewed mission that will carry 4 people to the moon sometime around, and they are saying this right now, 2023.
So no crew with Artemis
1. Wow, what?
No crew, no people.
But Jay, just to clarify, it'll be around the moon. They're not landing on the moon.
They're going to go around the moon, literally.
And come back.
And then the whole package comes back.
Will we still lose communication with them the way we used to lose communication with Apollo?
Why don't they just put a couple of
Why can't we relay a satellite? Why can't we use a satellite that's up there and relay?
I don't know. I hope we don't junk up the moon's orbit like we have junked up the Earth. The Artemis 1 mission will also have 13 small science satellites. I'm trying to find out all the details on them. I'm still reading up on it. And if they're satellites, it means that they're going to launch them somehow, but I couldn't find any details on that yet. During the 3-week mission, it will travel 280,000 miles from Earth. This will be the longest space mission a ship has performed without docking with a space station ever. Three weeks. High-def cameras plastered
all over this thing.
Oh, you know it, man. From the beginning, the SLS was designed and intended for deep space missions. And as an example, flying to the moon is 1,000 times farther than flying to the space station. Rocket has to reach 24,500 miles per hour to be able to get to the moon, right? That's how you pull away from the Earth. And the SLS will also run missions to Mars and possibly other planets in the solar system. It took over 3,200 companies to build the components for the SLS.
Whoa, 3,200.
Okay. And guys, I'm reading that the Block 1 configuration of SLS, 15% more thrust than Saturn V. 8.8 million pounds of maximum thrust. 15% more than Saturn V.
So the Chinese have a satellite in halo orbit around the L2 Lagrangian point of the moon, which does provide communication from the far side of the moon.
Cool. Okay. And what? I hope they'll let us use that.
Wait, is that a Lagrange point?
It's in a halo orbit around a Lagrangian point. Around the L2 point.
Interesting.
The Quiquayo relay satellite. Q-U-E-Q-I-A-O. Quiquayo.
Yeah. Sounds good to me.
But there's no reason why we can't put our own there, too.
I imagine we'll want one of our own eventually.
Yeah. Well, especially because we're going to have people coming and going and going and coming. I mean, we're going to need to be able to talk to people all the time.
Mm-hmm. Oh, but just think of the pictures that will come back from the far side of the moon and those high-res pictures. Oh, my gosh. It'd be awesome.
I know, right?
I cannot wait. I can't.
I know. We're going to see imagery of the moon. We're going to become so well acquainted with the moon in the next 20 years. It's going to be silly.
Yeah, it's probably true. All right. Thanks, Jay. In my intermittent series on brain-machine interfaces, whenever there's any significant study, I like to report on it. So this is a study where they looked at a brain implant to treat chronic pain. This was done in rats. Remember that segment from a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah.
Disclose up front, this was done in rats, not people. But they implanted a computer chip that both reads a brain activity, interprets that brain activity, and then reacts to the brain activity in order to reduce the perception of pain.
Wow.
Yeah. So it's so-called closed loop, right? So this is a closed loop brain machine interface, BMI. It's not dependent on anything external, to read it or to do anything. So the computer chip will read from the cingulate gyrus, which becomes activated when there is pain, right? And it not only reads that there's activity there, it actually can interpret the signals and using artificial intelligence to determine which signals indicate pain, right? The pattern of activation that is consistent with pain. And then when it detects that pattern, it connects to the frontal lobe, which activates a part of the frontal lobe that will inhibit that pain. Yeah, so the idea is whenever you get the pain centers get activated in the cingulate cortex, it then connects to the prefrontal cortex and reduces the pain. So it's only active when it needs to be, only when you would otherwise experience pain. The researchers say that their device is 80% accurate in detecting pain. So you might wonder, how do we know if a rat is in pain or not? So they use two methods. One was a withdraw test. So you do an escalating painful stimuli to the paw, usually heat, right? Like you slowly heat up the paw. Oh. And then you determine how many seconds until they pull it away. And if they delay pulling it away, they were, that means they had a higher pain tolerance, right? Does that make sense?
Yeah, sure.
So it, so in this case, because they could turn the stimulators on and off, they can be their own control, which is good, right? So the rats that had the stimulator turned on withdrew from a painful stimuli 40% more slowly than when those rats had their stimulator turned off.
40%, okay.
40%, yeah. So, you know, it's just a proof of concept when you're doing it in rats, obviously. Not, it's not not really, that you can't translate that directly into like what a human would experience.
Right.
They also had the rats in a cage that had two chambers. This is another part of the study. And in one chamber, their implant was active and the other one, it was off. And they spent twice as much time in the chamber where the implant was active than in the one where it was inactive. So they preferred whatever the sensation was of the stimulator being activated.
That's epic.
Yeah, this could, again, this is the kind of thing like maybe in 10 or 20 years, you know, this could be the kind of, you know, something that is an actual treatment for people. Maybe sooner, we'll see. But, you know, it's always, it's a good estimate from when you're talking about proof of concept rat studies.
Yeah.
People applications are probably 10 to 20 years away. Maybe even longer. So,
man, if I had super chronic pain like some people do, I'd like put that in my brain right now. Don't wait. You know, I don't care. I'll sign anything you want me to sign. Just put it in.
It certainly is an attractive sounding option. But let's go over some of the strengths and weaknesses of this kind of approach.
Okay.
So, first of all, right now, what approaches do we have for treating people with chronic pain? It's mostly pharmacological, right?
Drugs.
And no option is perfect. They all have their strengths and weaknesses. Some drugs, like the non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, like aspirin, ibuprofen, naproxen, those have a ceiling effect, right? They only can produce so much analgesia, pain relief. They also have side effects, like we just, you know, spoke about Tylenol. They might think they're benign, and they are if used intermittently and within the proper dosing, but, you know, they can cause ulcers and kidney effects for the NSAIDs, and Tylenol can cause liver effects. Some people can have allergies to them. Not everybody can take them. If you're on blood thinners, if you have a lot of GI disorders, like I see patients with IBS or ulcers or whatever, they can't take NSAIDs. Whole category of pain medication that you don't have available. And then, of course, there are narcotics, which are
good stuff.
Do not have a ceiling effect. They are very effective. They're as effective as you want them to be.
Highly based on addictive.
The dose that you take. But they are addictive, and you get tolerant to them. And they have withdrawal effects, and they, at the high doses, they suppress important things like breathing. You know, so you could OD.
Easy to overdose.
Fatal, yeah. So it's a very complicated, problematic, you know, class of drugs. When used appropriately and with proper monitoring, et cetera, and in the proper clinical setting, they're indispensable. They're very effective. Cancer, you know, pain, traumatic pain, surgical pain. Chronic pain's trickier, you know, because you can use them again in a very selective, very judicious way, but, you know, opioids could actually worsen chronic pain.
Oof.
And can actually cause neuropathic pain syndromes by themselves if you overuse them. Yeah, because you're down regulating the parts of your brain that inhibit pain. So you're essentially making people more sensitive to pain, which is not something you want to do to somebody who has chronic pain. And not only more sensitive to the pain, but more emotionally bothered by the pain, which is the big thing. Non-pharmacological interventions are mainly psychological, stress reduction, some kind of meditation or biofeedback, just teaching people to live with the pain, to distract themselves from the pain, to deal with the emotional side of the pain.
Yeah. Spock their way out of it.
Yeah. If it's what we call nociceptive pain, that's when there's tissue damage. And the nervous system is just doing its job, then you want to deal with the underlying cause of the pain, right? That's always optimal. You always want to fix the problem, not just treat the symptom. But some people have chronic pain, you know, the chronic lower back pain, for example, or they have chronic pain from arthritis, or there's lots of conditions that are not curable that can cause chronic pain. But then there's also neuropathic pain. Neuropathic pain means it's arising from within the nervous system. The nervous system is not doing its job. That's where the pathology is. That's the problem. The pain is the disorder. And that tends to be more chronic, harder to treat. We don't really treat that very well with, you know, with analgesics. You have to use neuropathic pain prophylaxis, which are different kinds of drugs. They're more like anti-seizure drugs and antidepressant drugs that affect the brain, and they and also affect peripheral nerves. And they're just trying to suppress this abnormal generation or conduction of pain signals. And they can be very effective, but, you know, nothing works in everybody. And there's lots of people who are difficult to manage or refractory to options. There are some other, some newer methods, which are basically peripheral nerve stimulation. And this is mostly based upon the counter-irritant idea that, you know how, like, if you bang your elbow and then it hurts, what do?
Rub it.
You rub it. And the rubbing activates other sensory pathways that then inhibit the pain pathways.
You get into a fist fight, you'll forget it quick.
Yeah, that's the counter-irritation phenomenon. And so there's a lot of stimulators that work that way. But honestly, if you look at the data, they don't really work very well. In fact, you could make a reasonable argument, given all the data, that it's not sufficient to prove that they actually work. But it's also reasonable to interpret the data as saying that they're mildly effective.
Wait, what specifically?
The peripheral nerve stimulation as a treatment for pain, either stimulating the spinal cord or stimulating nerves. We're getting into a new era now where we're doing brain stimulation, either with transcranial magnetic stimulation
or
nerve stimulation. Yeah, that's experimental. It's very interesting. It's the idea is instead of pharmacologically hacking the brain, we're going to electromagnetically hack the brain. The advantage there is that it's not limited by evolution, right? It's not limited by the specificity of receptor subtypes. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So the problem is the brain is a messy product of evolution, and so it shares neurotransmitters.
Evolution sucks.
And receptors. And so, you can only get as specific as the brain is specific in terms of its biochemistry, and which means not very. So you get lots of off-target effects that there's just no way around. We're getting as specific as we can, but we can't get more specific than evolution itself. But with electromagnetic stimulation, there is no theoretical limitation on how specific you can get. It's just a technological limit of how well you can isolate and manipulate specific circuits in the brain.
Steve, is there any downside to it? In other words, can we test it on people?
I'm just about to get there. So the downside of the brain hacking, like with this one, right, we're actually implanting a computer chip into the brain that's going to then stimulate pathways in the brain that inhibit pain, right? The advantage there is it could be very specific. There's no pharmacological side effects. There's no, none of the pharmaceutical downsides. It could be very, very effective. It could be a good long-term approach. Downside is it's invasive. You're installing a computer chip in your brain, or wires or something. So it's more invasive.
I know. It sounds pretty cool to me.
But here's the thing that we don't know. Just because you're stimulating a circuit electrically rather than pharmacologically doesn't mean you're not going to downregulate it. So imagine if you keep stimulating.
We don't know the answer to that.
Yeah, well, theoretically we do, but we need to see what the actual parameters are for this specific treatment. If you keep stimulating the part of the brain that inhibits pain, will it become harder and harder to stimulate that part of the brain? And will its baseline function decrease, which again would increase your baseline pain? So that's theoretically possible, but we'd have to see if it actually happens and to what extent in people. I mean, we also could test that in rats by just continuing to follow these rats. But rats don't live as long as people, so we won't be able to get the same kind of data that we would get. Maybe this would work great for the first 2 or 3 years, and then it just stops working, or it has side effects that are unintended. So you don't imagine that it's this perfect side effect-free intervention just because it's this new sexy brain stimulation thing. It could be everything we hope that it is, but we have to do the actual research to find out. And there are theoretical limitations there. But I do think this is going to be a fantastic new paradigm of brain treatment in the next 50 to 100 years. And then this is one little tiny example of why, because you could do things like, I'm going to directly stimulate that circuit in order to have the effect that I want in the brain. And really, I think there's two main ways in which this technology is improving. One is our understanding of the brain circuitry itself, which is pretty sophisticated and increasing all the time, but there's still a lot to learn as well. The brain is freakishly complicated, right? The other one, which is probably more of a limiting factor at this point, because there's still a lot of things that we would have at least a reasonable hypothesis about what we'd want to do, but it's just the hard technology of interfacing machines with the brain in a safe and long-term and sustainable way. Right, Jay? The brain pulsates. We need flexible, squishy electrodes or microwires or something. So
I thought about this. Maybe mine doesn't.
Oh, it does. It double pulsates, in fact.
I could hear it squelching right now.
Yeah. So we're working on various types of technology to do that. And, you know, we need not only wires that can interface with the brain long-term safely, not produce scar tissue, but we also, like, if you put a computer chip in the brain, that's going to produce heat. And again, human brains are a lot bigger than rat brains, and heat dissipation is more of an issue. So developing new technology with chips that use much less power and can harvest their power from biological sources so they don't have to worry about their battery running out, for example. We still need that technology, the electronic part of this technology, to advance greater. I think the one thing that's not a limiting factor is the software. I think that we're way ahead of the game as far as that's concerned. Like, the AI algorithms that we have are more than adequate to do what we want to do. And that, I think, will stay ahead of the applications here. I think the hardware and the neuroscience are the limiting factors, not the software. And of those two things, the hardware, I think, is the biggest limiting factor at this point in time. But this is an exciting new technology. Keep your eye on it. This is definitely going to be, going to be hearing more about this. Although, like, the actual clinical applications in people are still, you know, the real high-end stuff is still a little ways down the road. We're already seeing devices now that use more external stimulation. Yeah, I mean, I'd love to get to the point where we, you know, have the technology just directly interface electrically or magnetically with the brain.
Good stuff. All right, man.
Yeah, it's cool stuff. All right, Evan, this is an interesting little news item. It's also a brain related one. So, you know, we're going to chat about this. This is a report claiming that pupil size is related to intelligence.
Yeah, that's right, Steve. I mean, there may be two eyes in intelligence, but is there intelligence in our two eyes? Yes, I came up with that myself. Researchers from the Georgia Institute of Technology suggest that baseline pupil size is closely related to individual differences in intelligence. They describe this as a surprising correlation between baseline pupil size and several measures of cognitive ability. The larger the pupils, the higher the intelligence, as measured by tests of reasoning, attention, and memory. This study appeared in the journal Cognition, June 2021 edition. It is titled, "Is Baseline Pupil Size Related to Cognitive Ability?" Yes, under proper lighting conditions. The authors are Jason Sukahara and Randall Engel. And you know what I like about this news item? The researchers themselves, they reported the news. They wrote an article, news article about it. It appears in Scientific American. And we were talking about this recently, how it's better when the actual scientists that perform the study communicate their findings in the media as opposed to someone assigned to it or you know, someone who may not get all the facts straight. So I think that's a very good sign that they went ahead and wrote the article for this. Pupil size, what is that? All right, well, that refers to the diameter of the black circular aperture in the center of the eye. It ranges, it can range, changes from 2 to 8 millimeters. The pupil is surrounded by the colorful area known as the iris, which is responsible for controlling the size of the pupil. So across three different studies, they found that the difference in baseline pupil size between people who scored the highest on the cognitive tests and those who scored the lowest was large enough to be detected by the unaided eye. They discovered this relationship while studying differences in the amount of mental effort people use to complete memory tasks. So here was the study. The researchers recruited more than 500 people between the ages of 18 and 35, and they were all from the Atlanta, Georgia community. They measured their pupil size using an eye tracker, and that device captures the reflection of light off the pupil and the cornea using a high-powered camera and computer. Their pupils were measured at rest while they stared at a blank computer screen for up to 4 minutes. And using the tracker, they calculated each participant's average pupil size. And they kept the laboratory dim for all the participants due to the fact that pupils constrict in response to largely due to bright lights or bright surrounding lights. Participants then completed a series of cognitive tests designed to measure, well, a couple things. Fluid intelligence, which they describe as the capacity to reason out new problems. And they also ran tests to measure working memory capacity, and that's the ability to remember information over a period of time. And then they implemented an attention control test, and that's the ability to focus attention amid distractions and other interference. They described one of the attention control tests they implemented in the article. The participants had to resist glancing toward a bold flickering asterisk on one side of a computer screen and instead rapidly look into the opposite direction to identify a letter. The letter would disappear within moments, so if they were not paying attention, that you'd miss out. Like, you had to be paying attention or else you'd miss your chance. And so that was the attention test. The results: larger baseline pupil size was correlated with greater fluid intelligence, greater attention control, but to a lesser degree, working memory capacity. But it was still considered a measurable effect. The pupil size was negatively correlated with age. They say that older participants tended to have smaller, more constricted pupils. But once it was standardized for the age, the relationship between pupil size and cognitive ability remained. All right, and then they went on to speculate as to why. Why do they think the results came out the way they did? And here is the neurotech speak. And Steve, I'm sure you'll be lending some clarity to this. they say that the pupil size is related to activity in the locus coeruleus.
Locus coeruleus.
Locus coeruleus. That reminds me of Marcus Aurelius, right? It's locus coeruleus. Yes. And that
the
is
blue
a
blue spot.
The blue spot, right. Yeah, I saw that when I researched that. Also known as the blue spot. It is a nucleus situated in the upper brainstem with far-reaching neural connections to the rest of the brain. The locus coeruleus releases, it's a neurotransmitter and hormone in the brain and body. It regulates processes such as perception, attention, learning, and memory. And they say it also helps maintain a healthy organization of brain activity so that distant brain regions can work together to accomplish all the challenging tasks and goals that it has to perform. They said that there was a hypothesis that people who have the larger pupils at rest have greater regulation of activity by the locus coeruleus, which benefits cognitive performance and resting state brain function. But they also admit that we definitely need additional research to explore these possibilities and more. So they weren't necessarily saying this is it. These were just the results of this particular test. And Steve, what do you think?
So, you know, when I first saw it, I definitely was a little skeptical, but it's not completely outside of the realm of possibility. I had to see if, you know, first of all, who was doing this study and what did the data actually show. Because there's other studies where they're trying to make statements about the brain or other aspects of health just by looking at the eye. So I'm not talking about iridology. I'm talking about like pupil reactions or pupil size. So, but this is not part of that pseudoscience thing. I think this is legitimate research. So on the positive side, like what's going for this, you know, I think the locus coeruleus hypothesis is at least a reasonable place to start. It is involved with initiation of memory, with attention, and with activation of the brain more globally. And so you think, and of course, the pupils get larger with activation, with sympathetic activity. So it could just be an epiphenomenon that when things are more activated, you're getting a little bit more sympathetic tone going to the pupil, and it increases the pupil size. So that's not impossible that they've picked up on some epiphenomenon that is a marker for some aspect of brain function, right? So there's definitely a plausibility there. However, I noted that this has been shown by one research group and no other research group has been able to replicate the findings. So that's always a big red flag. Now, these researchers say that the reason no one else has replicated their finding is because they're not doing it right, which may be the case.
Well, that is a possibility.
And they say that's because you only will see this effect if it's not too bright. If it's too bright, then the pupil constricts because of the light and it obscures this resting pupil size phenomenon. They said they were using computer screens that were too bright in doing this test. Mm. And that the too bright computer screens were obscuring the result. Okay, maybe, but still, no one has replicated these results. So that's always like the sort of the ultimate test of, is this real, right? Fine. So some other group would need to replicate this research, making whatever fixes these authors think that they need to do before I think it's going to rise to the level of an accepted phenomenon. So right now it's still, I think, preliminary or speculative until it gets replicated.
Replication, such an important part of the whole process. Such an important part.
It's critical. It's absolutely critical. So we'll see. And then the question becomes, okay,
what do we do with this information?
What do we do with this information? Is it really, you know, it's a statistical phenomenon. Does it apply individually? Like is the variation among individuals greater than the statistical phenomenon that we're seeing? You know what I mean?
Yes.
It's like, sure. It's like saying, yeah, like men on average are taller than women, but that doesn't tell you anything. You know, you if you know the height of somebody, that doesn't tell you if they're a man or a woman. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Right.
So there's much more difference within a sex than between them. So yeah, its utility is another question. But I think these guys are mainly interested in just the phenomenon, you know? Then they get their name attached to it if it turns out to be validated. And then it'll be a neurological phenomenon. And it may teach us something about how the brain is wired up, you know, like that. So this is just basic science research. It's not necessarily going to lead to anything, but it is interesting. All right, Jay, it's Who's That Noisy time.
All right, guys, last week I played This Noisy. So, what do you guys think?
Well, you said it wasn't the obvious answer.
It's somebody singing a song, but there's got to be something special about that song.
Right, like a computer recorded it and then sang it back, something along those lines.
All right, Evan, actually, your guess is not uncommon. I had a lot of emails come in from people saying something kind of similar. We have a guest from someone named William Steele, and he writes in. He says, "Hi, Jay, my fiance suggested this week's noisy is a Muslim call to prayer." And he gives me an example. I listen to it. It's a little bit of that in there. It isn't the correct answer, but there is a little bit of a similarity between that. If you don't know what that is, you go look it up and take a listen. Another listener named Jay Williams wrote in and said, "Hi, Jay, is this human?" He said, "Is it a human?" And then he guessed the something that we've talked on the show about before a long time ago. He said prepubescent castration for the purposes of the music industry was almost entirely abandoned during the
castrati?
Late 18th century.
Yeah.
Yes. So I said in 1870 it was made illegal in Italy. And then there was a particular person named Alessandro Moreschi called the Angel of Rome, and he was a castrato and the only one whose voice was recorded. Pretty cool. So you should actually listen to that. That person's voice was very distinct. That is not correct, but I do think that that's a really cool guess. We have another listener named Scott Mac Alexander. He says, "Hi, Jay. I'm not sure why some listeners cannot distinguish between your voice and your brother's. I'm sorry I can't be more specific with this guess for this week's noisy. But does it have anything to do with the quarter tones and other types of microtonality often heard in non-Western musical scales?" And the answer to that, unfortunately, is no, even though that is a feature of this song. If you listen, you could hear some notes that seem to be in between notes that we're used to hearing. Another quick guess here sent in by a listener named Evil Eye, and he said, "Is it that blue chick alien thing in the movie The Fifth Element?"
Fifth Element, Lilo Dallas.
Christ, I could have said that a little bit better, huh? No, it's not. And I know exactly what character you're talking about, and that is a very memorable scene in that movie.
The blue chick.
We have a winner. I'm going to give it to Visto Tutti for the win.
All right.
Even though he didn't completely nail it, but he got really close. He said, "The vocal style sounds vaguely Turkic, and I get the feeling that this is a recreation of an ancient song, perhaps Phoenician." Very cool. You were damn close, man. You were damn close. So let me tell you what this noisy is. This was originally sent in by a listener named Randy Wilson, and Randy said, "Apparently dating from 1400 BCE, the Hurrian hymn is claimed to be the oldest known song, and although we don't know what it actually sounded like, there have been several attempts to instantiate it. And then he gives me an example of one, and this was done by the example that I played for you. It was done by Dr. Richard Dumbrill in 1998. So just take a listen again. This is the oldest, possibly the oldest song ever written down, ever recorded, or it happens to be the oldest one that we found so far. Very haunting, very interesting, mm-hmm. very beautiful.
I wonder how far back singing goes. I mean, it could be a million years for all we know.
Sure, I would say, absolutely.
Maybe, farther back maybe even than language, you know, or maybe back to when we just had proto-language. We were able to make, you know, notes like that and start to appreciate melody and tonality and stuff. But of course, there's no way to record it.
Yeah, but that's what's cool about musical notation, you know, because it is recorded in a sense. We have a new Noisy this week, Steve. This Noisy was sent in by a listener named Leslie Longhurst. Like to hit it, and hit it go. All right, there's a few different sounds in there. You could disregard the wind and disregard the human voices and listen to that with headphones on if you can, because there's some sounds in there that you might not pick up if you're listening to an open-air speaker. Very, very cool. I'm excited to talk about what it is next week. If you have any ideas on what that is, you can email me at wtn@theskepticsguide.org.
All right, thanks, Jay. One question this week. This one comes from Dan Edwards from Johnstown, Colorado. Hey, Dan, if you're going to be near Denver in November, come see us. Or we're going to be in Denver, and we're going to be in Fort Collins, so whichever is closer to Johnstown, which I don't know where that is in Colorado. Anyway, he writes, I know one of Steve's interests appears to be food production. I just wanted to make sure he saw this story. Then he links to a story about creating food from the air.
Ooh.
It's using air and solar power. So this was diet food, I assume.
What kind of food?
Study published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, or PNAS. Kara's not here to appreciate that.
She's not here to giggle.
So what they do is, they just basically use solar power in order to capture carbon from the atmosphere and turn that into a food that they then feed to microbes in a bioreactor. And then those microbes produce proteins, and they basically chop them up and purify the proteins for consumption by humans and animals. That's the idea. So what the study concluded was that using this technique, you could grow 10 times as much food on a given area of land as you could if you grew actual crops like soybeans. Soybeans are actually pretty efficient. And so if it's 10 times as efficient in terms of land use even than soybeans, that would be significant. Imagine that, right? If we just increase our food production by 10 times. But of course, this is only making protein, and we can't live off of protein. We would need, you know, carbohydrates and
some fats,
fatty acids, yep. and vitamins, and, you know, we need a more well-rounded source. So it would be interesting to calculate, like, realistically, what percentage of calories could healthfully come from this source. That'd be one thing that'd be interesting. Maybe you could replace a lot of animal protein. But the other thing is, what could we do with it? Because at the end, you get this powder, you know, which I guess would be similar to like growing crickets and grinding up making cricket powder. Mm-hmm. This would be bacteria powder. And I get, which then you could, you know, I'm sure you could bake with it. Or if you can get to the point where you could make something that is reasonably close to a hamburger with it, that would be awesome. So yeah, I wonder if something like this might be part of the food chain in the future, but it's certainly not going to replace all farming, right? Because, you know, we need the variety of plants, you know, in our diet. And yeah, we'll see, you know, we'll have to see if that 10 times efficiency holds up, or maybe as solar panels get more efficient, it might even become greater. Probably, you know, I wouldn't doubt that some kind of process like this. You guys remember Blade Runner? The more recent one, was it 2047?
Yeah.
When the guy was like growing grubs, like that was what, mm-hmm. that was their food yeah. production. He was just growing grubs sure. and bats.
Yeah.
So,
well,
yeah, you know, you wonder if that's in our future. Mm. You know, some, we talked about micro farming, you know, micro husbandry of insects, which you could produce a far greater amount of, you know, calories per acre of land than you can from mammals or birds or even fish, you know, because they're small. Insects are very efficient. This might even be more efficient than that. So I guess in the future we'll just be eating Soylent Green.
What's it made of?
It's bacteria.
I wouldn't have as much trouble eating bacteria as I would insects.
People? Oh, insects?
Yeah. Yeah.
At the end of the day, it's a powder. Right?
What, yeah, so what do you really care? Even know what you're consuming at a certain point.
I have a stigma with eating insects. I just don't.
Well, don't go to restaurants then, because, you know.
Do you eat shellfish? Yeah, but those are basically the insects of the sea, so.
Guess what they feed on?
They're arthropods, just like insects are. Right? I mean, you can't eat a grasshopper, but you could eat a shrimp.
I mean, it in some way, the bugs eventually get into you, Jay. It's whether another animal ate them and then you eat that animal, right? I mean, mm-hmm. it's part of the food chain. It
You're
just
correct.
Is.
I know. I'm saying I have a stigma about it.
Okay, don't get your pulsating brain all out of whack now.
No, but I definitely do, for some reason, have kind of a yuck factor when it comes to. I have two things that really yuck me out, and one of them is like eating any kind of insect, and the other one is like a wet, super damp, musty, nasty kind of building. You know what I mean?
Like, yes. I do know.
You know, like water dripping from the sun. Like, remember in Fight Club? You remember the building that they lived in?
Oh, you must have been crawling.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God. Yeah, it was bad.
What if you have a building like that and there are cockroaches climbing up the walls?
Yes.
Yeah, forget it. Then I'm in hell. I'm in room 3 in hell, you know.
Goodbye.
<Yeah. laughs> Don't move to Baltimore. I shouldn't say that, but when I lived in Baltimore, man, those, you know, like cockroaches are endemic.
Unfortunately.
Just a part of life.
Yep.
Just there. That's one of the things I like about living in the woods, says Kara says.
That's right, because other animals eat those things before they get into your house.
Yeah, I mean, we have infestations. Like, our big thing is mice, you know, and we may get termites and stuff, and I get woodpeckers trying to bore for stuff in the side of my house sometimes. But we don't have cockroaches. Which is good.
Yeah, very. Yeah, I've rarely seen them here.
It's easier to deal with mice than cockroaches. You can like eradicate mice from your house. If you have cockroaches, really hard.
Very tough. Bugs are tough.
Yeah.
The stink bugs, right? Every year we ask our extermination contractors, "Well, mm-hmm. what can you do about stink bugs?" And they said nothing.
Really?
That's it. Yeah, they don't have a remedy for it.
I don't know that we have stink bugs in our house. Nothing significant that I've noticed. There's always little bugs crawling around all over the place.
Ladybugs.
Like twice
bugs.
A year, we get an infestation of ladybugs. Like they like bloom. They're all over the windowsill. And we get, if we leave fruit out, we definitely get fruit flies.
Oh, yeah, those fruit flies.
But you never get fruit bats, which I find weird.
No fruit bats, but I wish we did. Those things
That'd
are
be
horrible.
Epic.
Yeah, they're
And
very
we
cute.
Saw the bats in Australia. Mm-hmm. Around sunset, they would all take wing at the same time and
fly down the street.
Yeah. Oh, that was so cool.
Epic. Oh, my God.
All right, guys, let's go on to science or fiction.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week, I come up with 3 science news items or facts, 2 real and 1 fake. And I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. We have 3 regular news items this week. Are you guys ready?
Let's do it.
Okay.
All right, here we go. Item number 1. Scientists have developed a prototype energy production system involving filling balloons with compressed air, then harvesting energy as they float to the surface, showing such a system is as efficient as a large wind turbine. Item number 2. New calculations find that of all exoplanets discovered so far, only one would be able to barely sustain an Earth-like biosphere. Item number three, a new study finds that a computer simulation was as good at predicting the effectiveness of a treatment for aneurysms as actual human clinical trials.
Oh.
Bob, was that you volunteering to go first?
I said nothing.
His voluntary groan.
Involuntary.
Oh, was it involuntary?
That's why I try to remain quiet.
You were triggered.
Your locus coeruleus isn't active enough.
Marcus Aurelius.
Oh, crap. All right, let's see. Prototype energy production system. Filling balloons with compressed air, then harvesting energy as they float to the surface of what?
The water.
The water?
Yeah. Is that not clear?
No, I mean, I kind of inferred it, but I want to hear
it. I guess I didn't say that explicitly. I thought I did.
Huh. Really? How would you do that? Filling it there so it takes less energy to compress it and bring it down. That's where it might fall apart. Let's look at the next one. Exoplanets. Only one, huh? Oh, damn.
There can be only one.
I haven't been tracking these, but I know they found there's a bunch that were promising, but sustain an Earth-like biosphere. I mean, one wouldn't surprise me, I'll just say that. And see, the third one, something that I've been talking about on the show for years. Computer simulation, predicting something as complex as the effectiveness of a treatment for aneurysms. Wow. Predicting. So computer simulation. Wow. I mean, I want that to be so true. I mean, well, let me think. The effectiveness. I mean, how complex? It's basically circulatory. It's not like you'd have to, like, simulate the brain. But, I mean, it is biology, after all. Huh. Damn, man. The balloons, huh? Yeah, I think that's going to fall apart once you factor in the energy cost. But then again, maybe you could produce the air. You could pull it right out of the water on the seafloor. Have to be some big balloons. All right, I'm going to say aneurysm fiction.
Okay, Jay.
Steve, this first one about the balloons. You're saying they compress air. They bring it underwater. They fill balloons up underwater with air, and then they release the balloons, and then they somehow collect energy from those rising balloons, and it produces more energy?
That's the basic idea, yeah. I might be skimping over some specific details here, but...
But, I mean, it just sounds like, you know, where's that energy coming from then? That's
like, you know who runs this?
Who?
Mr. Balloon Hands.
Mr. Balloon Hands. No way. No way. Not my chair, not my problem. So, Steve... It seems so obvious that this one is the fiction, and I know sometimes you like to play games with us like that. I have to say this one is the fiction without even going to the other two, just because you fill up a tank, you bring it down. Well, maybe compressing the air. It's in the tank. It's so – oh, God, this one is such a puzzle. I'm going to say that this one's the fiction. The balloons are the fiction because there's something missing out of this that we don't get that it can't be.
And Evan.
So with the balloon one, how are they harvesting the energy?
It's not stated. And Jay's assuming tanks and stuff. It's not stated in the information I gave you.
But how is that as efficient as a large wind turbine? I think that's the problem maybe with this one. I don't. It's that efficient? Oh, boy. That would be tough.
How efficient is a wind turbine?
I mean, you'd have to go. It's a lot of energy and effort to make this balloon rise from down in the depths of the ocean. It seems impractical. So I think I'm leaning with Jay on that one being the fiction. The exoplanet one that to sustain an Earth-like biosphere, I think so. We've talked about other exoplanets who are tidally locked, and you could live on that little stretch right between the hot and the cold. But
yeah,
they probably don't have that Earth-like biosphere that would have been a planet like that can't have it, I don't think. And then the computer simulation, as good as predicting as human clinical trials? Okay. I think the balloon one's the least plausible of these. So I'll go with Jay.
Okay. So you all agree on the middle one, so we'll start there. New calculations find that of all exoplanets discovered so far, only one would be able to barely sustain an Earth-like biosphere. You all think this one is science, and this one is science.
Yay.
Sad.
Of course. Yay. One, huh? So sad. Far, so
only
good.
One. It just means we have to search for many, 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 many more exoplanets.
Yeah, so what they did...
That implies a surface biosphere too, doesn't it?
So the paper is efficiency of oxygenic photosynthesis on Earth-like planets in the habitable zone by Giovanni Cavone et al., published in the monthly notices of the Royal Astronomical Society. So what they did was they said, okay, if we just take, based on the color of the star... and therefore the wavelength of starlight that would be reaching a planet in the habitable zone, how much energy would that produce? Would that be able to drive Earth-like photosynthesis? So the Earth-like biosphere was critical there. They're assuming oxygenic photosynthesis like we have on Earth. And then how much life would that be able to sustain? So what they found was if for red stars, like red dwarfs, they won't even be able to generate photosynthesis. So they're not, yeah. Right? They would have to, life would have to evolve some alternate pathway. And it's not impossible that that could happen, just they would have to find some way to create some other kind of reaction, but they wouldn't be able to do photosynthesis like we have on Earth. You have to get at least into the orange stars, the K-type stars.
What about chemosynthetic?
That's separate. It would have to be chemosynthetic, but that wouldn't be an Earth-like biosphere.
Well, we have chemosynthetic biospheres.
Yeah, but it's teeny tiny. It's also a mount. It's also not just that there's...
Gotcha. Yep.
It's also that it's a robust biosphere. I know that Earth-like is doing a lot of heavy lifting in that
statement.
Yeah,
it is.
I get that.
I saw that.
Yeah, so they said, yeah, so in the orange stars, they would be fine. That would be enough, depending on how close they were. But it would be a spectrum in terms of how robust it is. So there's only one planet so far that... is in that range. It's an orange star, and it would Kepler-442b.
Oh, so not, they had C, yeah, but B. Gotcha.
B, yeah. So it has what they discovered. A is always the star,
right?
And then B would be the first planet discovered in the system. So they measure what's called the PAR, par photon flux, of the biosphere. So that Kepler-442b would be able to sustain an Earth-like biosphere, but it's just barely at the low end of the range that would be able to do that. But no other exoplanet has a photon flux that would be able to do that. It would be able to make anything that's in the orange to yellow range would be able to support life. But at the low end, it would be able to support a biosphere like Earth. And they said if you get too big beyond yellow, you get to the white or blue stars. Yeah, they produce tremendous amounts of energy, but they're very short-lived. You wouldn't have time to evolve a biosphere like Earth. So they're trying to decide, like, what's the range where we're going to find planets that are going to be truly Earth-like in terms of their biosphere? And it's really the orange and yellow stars, which is fine because those are the ones we thought would be the best candidates anyway. And in fact, of those, the orange stars are probably the best place for us to look for a couple of reasons. Well, mainly because they live longer than yellow stars, and there's more of them. If we had to pick which stars to look at for life, that's probably going to be the greatest number. Mm-hmm. Red dwarfs, red stars, they just don't produce enough energy. Planets in the habitable zone will probably be tidally locked. They're very unstable when they're young, and they would probably sterilize any planets too close to them.
Sterilize.
Just not looking good for the red dwarfs.
It never really did.
Can't rule it out entirely, but it wouldn't be good. Now, of course, we theoretically could be looking at habitable planets from two perspectives. One is looking for planets with life, but the other might be looking for planets to build settlements on, right? So it doesn't matter what their history was, as long as they would be able to have an environment that was comfortable for humans. That's all that would really matter, right?
True.
Okay, let's go back to number one. Scientists have developed a prototype energy production system involving filling balloons with compressed air and then harvesting energy as they float to the surface of the water, showing such a system is as efficient as a large wind turbine. Jay and Evan, you think this one is the fiction. Bob, you think this one is science. And this one is...
Say it.
The fiction.
Oh, yes. Crap.
You should have gone with your initial sense there, Bob, because you were correct. So this is not a system that produces energy. This is a system that stores energy.
Yeah. It stores it?
Yeah. So this is they're considering this for as a storage system. So like, for example, if you have offshore wind turbines, you can have one of these systems. They're calling these BEST for buoyancy energy storage technology. And there's basically two versions of them. In the original version, you have a floating base and then you sink, you use the electricity that's being generated in order to submerge balloons, and then you get the energy back when you float them back to the surface. Right.
Cool.
So it typically consists of floating platforms placed close to offshore wind farms and uses an electrical motor generator for storing energy by lowering a compressed gas recipient balloon, usually a series of balloons or tanks in locations with deep sea floors, and generating electricity by allowing the compressed gas recipient to rise through the water. They also propose new components for the construction of such a system, such as introduction of a series of high-density plastic pipelines arranged vertically to form a cube coupled with an anchor system connected to the seafloor. So, and they say that this would have the efficiency of pumped hydro and would be more efficient than batteries in storing electricity. $50 to $100 per megawatt hour versus $150 for lithium-ion batteries. But of course, that's getting better all the time too. But you know, it still could be a good system. You know, again, if you couple it with offshore wind turbines and you just could store the energy that they're producing right there. Yeah, I don't know if it would ever come into being, but it's an interesting idea.
You never know.
You never know. We have to keep looking for unique ways. You know, innovative ways of storing massive amounts of energy. Grid storage is going to be a huge challenge going forward. For the, you know, the green economy, you know, grid storage is one of the big unknowns in terms of what the future grid's going to look like. Okay, all this means that a new study finds that a computer simulation was as good at predicting the effectiveness of a treatment for aneurysms as actual human clinical trials is science. And this is very interesting.
Wow.
Yeah, so what they did was they used a computer simulation in silico, as we say, right? In vitro is in glass, which means that's like in a petri dish. In vivo is in life, and in silico is in a computer simulation.
Yeah. Don't forget in meatball.
In meato. So they were looking at a treatment that we already did three clinical trials on, right? So they already had the data from three clinical trials. And then they created virtual patients with, you know, simulated different anatomical variations on their arteries. And they looked at different configurations of this flow diversion device. So, you know, the thing about an aneurysm is an outpouching in an artery. The problem is that as blood flows through it, it could slowly enlarge the aneurysm. And as the wall gets too thin, it could burst.
Eesh.
And then
you're in trouble.
It's catastrophic, right? Depending on where it is. Often could be fatal if it's, you know, bad enough. But a diversion device essentially diverts blood flow away from the aneurysm so it doesn't get bigger and burst. The simulation predicted that the intervention would be 82.9% effective. The three clinical trials predicted it would be 86%, 74%, and 76%. Hmm. So pretty much right in the middle of those three clinical trials. So that's why I said it predicted it as well as human clinical trials, because they were comparing it to ones that were already done. So obviously, this could have huge benefits. It's much cheaper to do a simulation in a computer than to do a clinical trial with people. It could reduce the time from years to do a clinical, you know, doing the clinical trials down to just months, you know, to develop and run the simulations. They're not definitive, of course. I don't think we're going to be getting FDA approval anytime soon based upon computer simulations. But the hope is that it will be a good way to test the feasibility and the probability of a clinical trial being successful. You know, we want to do as much preliminary work as possible so that by the time we get to a clinical trial, we're proving something in people that has the maximal probability of being safe and effective because we've done all of the preclinical testing. So that's, I think, the role this will fill. how long will it be between these get so good that they could actually replace human clinical trials? I wouldn't predict that. That, you know, that's an unknown amount of time. It's yeah. That would be hard. That would be hard to be able to say, yes, we're going to base our final decision on just a computer simulation. It's hard because that assumes that we know everything biologically about the system that we're testing, you know. And again, I think the aneurysm one is low hanging fruit because it's just plumbing. You know, it's not like we're trying to predict biochemistry or something. This is actually a more of a self-contained system than like predicting the metabolism of a drug and drug-drug interactions and eliminate all that stuff, all that pharmacokinetics, pharmacodynamics. You know, you're not going to be able to figure that out definitively.
Low-hanging fruit. This is on the ground.
Yeah, in a computer simulation, but it does drive the research. You know, pharmaceutical companies do use this to predict how drugs should behave. You know, so we're trying to just get a few steps ahead, so that by the time we actually do the expensive hard stuff, we've maximized the chance of success. And again, that could significantly reduce the cost of clinical trials, significantly reduce the time of the entire research arc, you know, from concept to the clinic, to a medical application. So it's a great addition to the whole research process. And this is a great proof of concept, but obviously there's a long way to go. You know, there's a lot of research that needs to be done to really show the reliability, you know, the utility of these systems. But this is encouraging.
Yeah.
All right. So good job, guys.
Good job.
Fun one. Evan, give us a quote.
There is nothing noble in being superior to your fellow man. True nobility is being superior to your former self. That was written by Ernest Hemingway.
Mm-hmm. I love that quote.
And it's a really nice quote. It reminds us, you know, it's about humility. It's about concentrating more on just your own self-improvement rather than trying to measure yourself up necessarily to other people all the time. You know, just concentrate on trying to be the best person that you can be and always search for ways to improve, ways to modify, ways to become just better than you once were. And you kind of can't go wrong if you take that attitude. So I like that quote.
You have to learn how to witness your own behavior.
Which can be very challenging, you know, looking in the mirror and an honest assessment. And, you know, it's good to have good friends to also kind of help you, remind you of those times, because you bring up a very good point. You can't always see it in yourself.
Your own thinking.
Yes.
Metacognition.
Abso-freaking-lutely. Every day.
Jay, can you witness your behavior in a mirror if it's a chiral image?
No, you cannot.
Sure?
Thank you.
You owe me $100.
But two mirrors in a barber shop, right? Face to face. Oh, well, that's a whole other story.
Yeah, don't fall into that. Bits. Be careful.
All right, guys. Well, thanks for joining me this week.
Of course. Man.
Thank you, Steve.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information, visit us at theskepticsguide.org. Send your questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. And if you would like to support the show and all the work that we do, go to patreon.com/skepticsguide and consider becoming a patron and becoming part of the SGU community. Our listeners and supporters are what make SGU possible. We'll be right back.